Okay, so I said we would look at how Rudolf Bultmann deals with the baptism of Jesus. So open your Bible to Mark chapter 1, just in case you did not read this during the break. Mark chapter 1, who would like to read verses? Actually, Otto, why don't you read? You can turn your mic on. If you have a mic. Mark chapter 1, verses 9 to 11.
I only have the Finnish Bible.
Read it in Finnish. Everyone has their own Bible in front of us. God understands Finnish, mostly.
Okay, wait a second. It's on my phone, so. 10 seconds, please.
Okay.
Okay, in Finnish for you.
In Finnish, Mark 1, 9 to 11.
Ja niinä päivinä Jeesus tuli Galilean Nasaretista ja Johannes kastoi hänet Jordanissa. Ja heti vedestä noustessaan hän näki taivasten aukeavan ja hengen niin kuin kyyhkysen laskeutuvan häneen. Ja taivaista tuli ääni, sinä olet minun rakas poikani, sinun minä olen mielistynyt.
Very understandable.
Hmm.
Easy. Okay. Baptism of Jesus. And one of the things Bultmann looks at in his book, in his analysis of this, is to analyze a controversial interpretation of the baptism of Jesus. And that is the idea that the baptism of Jesus is actually a call by God for Jesus to begin his ministry. Now, there were some, we could say, early heretics that actually said Jesus became the Messiah at this point in time. He wasn't, and then he became the Messiah, which is heresy, the church said, because Jesus is eternally God. He's eternally the Messiah. But still, there's some people have said that what is happening in the baptism is God calling Jesus to begin his ministry. And that's the question we're going to look at and that Bultmann looks at. Is this a call? And Bultmann said, there are lots of different calls in the Bible, call stories. There's so many different call stories that he was willing to call that its own genre. Okay, in biblical form criticism, they have very, very specific genres. So there's a genre of a call story. And so Bultmann says, well, then let's compare the baptism of Jesus with other call stories in the Bible and see if they fit together. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to look at three different call stories in the Bible, one in the Old Testament, two in the New Testament. So we need to read all of these. So open your Bibles and can somebody look up Isaiah 6? Let's just name names here. Hannah, can you look up Isaiah 6? Irina, John 21. And Daniel, Revelation 1. Okay. These are all call stories, and Bultmann uses them to compare with the baptism of Jesus. So Isaiah 6, verses 1 to 9. Anna, do you have that? Okay.
Sel aastal, kui kuningas Ussia Hõvei nägi meissandud istuvad suurel ja kõrge laulajärjel, ja tema kuuad valmistuse ulatusid templi seinast seina. Temast kõrgemal seisid seeradid, iga ühel neist oli kuus tiiga. Kahekata kaitis oma pale, kahekata kaitis oma jalgu ja kahekata lenda. Ja need püüdsid üksteisele ning ütlesid. Püha, püha, püha on väga lihtsam. Kogu maailm on täis tema olu. Ja ukse piirad vabisesid hüüdjas hääles ning koda täitus suituga. Ja ma ütlesin, häda mulle, sest ma olen kadunud. Sellepärast, et ma olen roojane mees kuulte, elan roojaste hulkega rahva keskel. Sellepärast, et mu silmad on näinud kuningat väge rissalda. Siis lendas mu juurde üks seeramites ja tal oli käes elavad süsti, mille ta oli pintidega altarini võtta. Ja ta kuulutas mu suurt ning ütles, vaata, see puudutas sinu kuuli ja su tüü on lahkunud ning su kat lepitatud. Ja ma kuulsin issanda häält küsivad, keda ma lähitan, kes meid läheks? Ja ma ütlesin, vaata, siin ma olen, lähita mind. Ja tema ütles, mine ja ütle sellele rahvale. Kuuldes kuulete ega mõista, nähes näete ega taipa.
Okay, now before we read the next two, I want you to pay attention to anything that is similar from Isaiah and then in John and Revelation. And remember, form criticism doesn't look at the surface details because the surface details are going to be totally different. It looks more at the structure of what is happening. It's the form. Okay, so let's go to John 21. Irina, I'm going to read that, verses 15 to 17. And like I said, pay attention to see if you can notice what is similar. So John 21, verses 15 to 17.
Когда же они обедали, Иисус говорит Симону Петру, Симон Иоанн, любишь ли ты меня больше, нежели они? Петр говорит ему, да, Господи, ты знаешь, что я люблю тебя. Иисус говорит ему, паси агнцев моих. Еще говорит ему в другой раз, Симон Иоанн, любишь ли ты меня? Петр говорит ему, так, Господи, ты знаешь, что я люблю тебя. Иисус говорит ему, паси овец моих. Говорит ему в третий раз, Симон Иоанн, любишь ли ты меня? Петр опечалился, что в третий раз спросил его, любишь ли ты меня? И сказал ему, Господи, ты все знаешь, ты знаешь, что я люблю тебя. Иисус говорит ему, паси овец моих.
Okay. Did you see any similarities? All right, let's try the third one. And again, don't look at the surface details. Those are totally different, but look at the deeper kind of structure of what is happening. So Revelation 1, verses 9 to 19.
Я, Иоанн, ваш брат, в единении с Иисусом, разделяющий с вами веру, царство и был на острове Патмос за слово Божье и свидетельство Иисуса. День Господень я был во власти Духа и услышал за спиной громкий голос, звучавший как труба. Он говорил, запиши в свиток все, что видишь, и пошли тяниться к вам. В Эфес, Мирну, Пергам, Иотиру, Сарды, Филадельфию и Владыкию. Я повернулся, чтобы увидеть, чей это голос говорил со мной, и повернувшись, увидел семь золотых светильников, а посреди светильников словно бы человека в длинном одеянии и опоясанного по груди золотым поясом. Голова его и волосы были белы, как белая шерсть, как снег. Глаза его, как пылающий огонь, а ноги словно сверкающий металл, раскаленный в горне, и голос его словно грохот водопада. В правой руке у него семь звезд, и из уст его исходит обоюдо острый меч. Весь облик его, словно палящее солнце в зените. И когда я увидел его, я пал к его ногам, как мертвый. Он положил на меня свою правую руку и сказал, не бойся, я первый и последний, я тот, кто живет. Я был мертв, но вот я снова живу во веки веков, и у меня ключи от смерти и ада. Итак, запиши, что ты увидел, то, что есть, и то, чему суждено совершиться потом.
Okay, do you see the similarities?
No.
No. Okay. Well, Bultmann says that call stories in the Bible have a similar basic structure in the sense that there's a similar form of what is happening, that there are similarities. He says a call story in the Bible typically will say something about the inner experience of the person who is being called. How does he experience this in his heart? How does he feel about this? So, Isaiah, how does Isaiah feel Hannah, you read it? So what did Isaiah feel? Makes it a lot easier if you have the PowerPoint already open, but I hope you don't. You're looking at the PowerPoint, right? Yeah, then you already know the answer. So what did Isaiah feel? What's his inner experience? Yeah, it's one way to put it. I'll just use one word. He's terrified. He's afraid. He says, I'm going to die. Yeah, his inner experience is one of fear. What about Peter? John 21. What is Peter's inner experience? I don't have the translation, but I'm guessing it something like that. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, he's hurt. He feels bad. He's grieved. What about John on the island of Patmos? Revelation. Again, fear. Understandable. It's Isaiah and both of them. Understandable. It's kind of scary. Okay, so the inner experience is given. Secondly, Boltman said, call stories typically give the reaction of the person. How does the person react or respond? So, Isaiah, what is his response? What does he say? Verse 8. Here I am, send me. Right? Here I am, send me. Verse 8. That's what Isaiah, that's how he reacts. That's how he responds. What about Peter? You know that I love you. Peter responds. He reacts. He says, you know that I love you. What about John on the island of Patmos? How does he react? How does he respond? He doesn't. He doesn't say anything at this stage in this. He doesn't react, actually. And that's okay, because logically, obviously, these are not laws that every call story must have these exactly. This is simply analyzing what is normal, what's the common pattern. But obviously, the author has the freedom to vary the pattern. Okay, we have to allow them some flexibility. This is not a law that they must follow. So, okay, we can move on. Boltman's okay with that. We can move on. The third obvious characteristic, a call story must have a call, a commission to do something. That's why it's called a call story, is because you are called to do something. So, Isaiah, what is he called to do? Go and tell these people. Go be a prophet. He's called to be a prophet. Peter, what is he called to do? Feed my sheep. Exactly. He is told he needs to do something. Go feed my sheep, Jesus said. What about John on the island of Patmos? Right. Write down what you see. Exactly. Okay. So Boltman says, we have numerous call stories in the Bible, and they generally have these three points. It's not an absolute law that they must. That would be nonsense. But generally speaking, they do. John on the island of Patmos, Revelation 1, that's definitely a call story. But it doesn't have all three points, but that's okay. It's still a call story. Okay, now what about the baptism of Jesus that we read first? How does it compare here? Does the baptism of Jesus in Mark 1 tell us anything about Jesus's inner experience? No. Jesus is, well, he goes into the water and he comes out of the water, but Jesus, we don't have any hint of what he's feeling at this moment. It's not there at all. What about a reaction from Jesus? Does he say something? No. He simply comes out of the water, but he doesn't react. He doesn't say anything. There's no reaction. What about a commission? Over the years and centuries, occasionally when people have pushed this idea that God is calling Jesus to begin his ministry, they say, well, there's an implied call. When the voice from heaven says, "You are my beloved son. This is my beloved son. Listen to him." It is implying that now Jesus should begin speaking and teaching and working as the Messiah. So they say it is an implied call. Well, maybe. But it's not clear that it's a call to Jesus to do anything. It doesn't actually call Jesus to do anything. And Boltman says that's exactly it. What Boltman says is if it followed the other characteristics. For example, if it gave something of the inner experience of Jesus, if there was a reaction from Jesus, then maybe you could say that it's kind of a call story. But the fact that it doesn't fit any of the characteristics of the other call stories in the Bible shows that really you have no basis to say that God is, that this is a call for Jesus to begin his ministry. And so Boltman says, this is not a call story. It has nothing to do with calling Jesus to begin his ministry. But Peter, John chapter 21, this encounter between Peter and Jesus after the resurrection, how do we usually interpret that story? What do we emphasize? When we read that story, if someone would preach from that story, what would be the main point that we would emphasize?
Maybe grace and restoration.
Exactly. Grace, restoration, forgiveness. Peter has denied Jesus, and Jesus is forgiving him, restoring him. And that's all beautiful and true and wonderful. If I would ask that same exact question in a Catholic seminary, what would they say? They would say, well, yes, all of that stuff is true, but this is Peter, who will become the first head of the church in Rome, the first pope, and upon this rock I will build my church, Jesus said. For Catholics, Peter's position as the head of the apostles, the first leader of the Christian church after Jesus, is incredibly important. Catholics will emphasize this is Jesus calling Peter to ministry. Feed my sheep. Be the shepherd. Be the pastor of my sheep. Protestants tend to avoid that because we don't want to emphasize Peter and the Pope, who is the successor of Peter in the Catholic understanding. And so Protestants, ever since Martin Luther broke away from Rome, Protestants tend to read this story primarily as forgiveness. But Boltman says, Boltman was Lutheran, by the way, Boltman said, really, this the structure of the story is a call story. It is firstly calling Peter to ministry. Yes, that involves forgiveness, restoration, grace, all of that. But it is a call story, and you should not ignore that. The form structure shows that. So, what do you think? Good, bad, helpful, unhelpful?
Oh, we don't know about the examples. Or maybe if we will check the Bible, we will find more examples.
Oh, you mean other examples of call stories, yeah, to get into it in more detail? Well, you can read Boltman's book. It's been a long time since I've read it. I don't remember how many call stories he goes through. But he was very thorough. He probably went through them all. But is that something positive in terms of biblical studies?
Yeah,
I think so. I think it is. I think this is something positive that we can, if we want to really go in deep, this can be a good, useful tool. Absolutely.
Mark, can I just comment one thing?
Yeah.
Just thinking about this Jesus baptism, I cannot agree that it would fall into this call category, because I think the whole point maybe could be there that God the Father is actually saying that that he is my beloved son, even if he hasn't done anything as yet ministry-wise. I don't know if you can get my point. Like God the Father is not like, I better not explain any further, but so that there's the Father's love is already there, even though Jesus didn't perform anything as yet.
Yeah, I like the way you're thinking, and this is excellent for a pastor, very pastoral. The Father loves even if you haven't done anything. Your Father loves you even if you've never done anything at all. He just loves you because he's your Father. Is that kind of what you're saying, Mari?
Yeah, it wasn't originally my own thought.
But I think that's very true. And I think going in the same direction, just taking it more, let's say, more theologically, Jesus is the Son before he does anything. Even without doing anything on earth, he was the Son for eternity past. I mean, John 1, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. He is the second person of the Trinity. He is God the Son. It's a statement of who he is and who the Father sees him to be. It's not directly about what he will do, although he does what he does because of who he is and can't separate them. Yeah.
Nagu selle järgi saab öelda, et see ei ole kutsumise lugu või see on kutsumise lugu. Sest Mari ütles ka, et ta ei ütleks, et see on nagu Jeesu ristimine on kutsumise lugu.
Oota, et see on see, nüüd mul on segadus.
See on see kirjanduslik žanr, mis on kutsumise lood.
Yeah.
Aga siis see Markuse evangeeliumi lugu, see Jeesuse ristimine, et see ei ole kutsumise lugu.
Yeah, according to Boltman, I'm just going through Boltman's analysis. Mm-hmm. Mark 1, the baptism of Jesus is not a call story. Mm-hmm. And I think, Mari, I thought you agreed with that, didn't you? Or do you think it is?
No, she
agreed with that. Yeah, that's what I thought. Mm-hmm. Okay, I was confused.
We are confused because it's in the same...
Because I put it in the same table. Yes. Okay, I just put it in the table for comparison sake. So you can see it's not this, it doesn't hit any of the categories. Yeah, no, it's not, according to Boltman. And I totally agree with Boltman on this. One of the few things I'll say I agree with Boltman on I disagree with him on a lot, but on this, I agree. I think that's a good analysis. So, form criticism has a lot of positive things that it can offer to biblical studies. This is helpful, in my opinion. And even if you think of like this big story of how the biblical text developed, there is some truth in it. Many of the Old Testament stories, let's say the book of Genesis, the stories of Abraham, the story of the flood, the Tower of Babel, I think it's very likely that those stories did exist as oral stories that were passed from generation to generation. The Tower of Babel, for example, was told generation after generation, or the flood, and even Abraham's stories were probably told by generation after generation until finally they were written down. I can accept that in that case. For the Gospels, the stories of Jesus probably also were passed around by word of mouth for several decades. And we'll get to this later. But there's probably about 25 years between the crucifixion and the writing of the first of the canonical Gospels. So there's about a 25-year period where the stories of Jesus were passed around by word of mouth. Somebody says, you know, I was there on the sermon on the mountain and I heard Jesus and Jesus said this. And that story is passed around. And then 25 years later, Mark writes his gospel and Matthew, Luke, they put it in written form. So there's a little bit of truth in this, even. The prophets, perhaps as well. Many of the prophets, it's very possible that they gave their message spoken. I think the vast majority of the prophets first spoke their message. And it's not one book. Isaiah didn't start speaking and then speak the whole book of Isaiah and someone wrote it down. They were individual messages that the prophet gave. And at some point, either Isaiah himself or someone else collected them and put them together into the book. So there can be some truth behind this. And the way form criticism analyzes the passages can be very helpful. Looking at it from the perspective of genre like this and comparing similar passages of call stories or miracle stories or whatever can be very helpful for us. So there's a lot of things here that are helpful. Sitz im Leben, we talked about before lunch. What is the situation in life of the story? Let's take an example. Open your Bible to the book of Psalms, Psalm 120. Many of you probably already know this example, but it's a very, very simple example. Psalm 120. In Russian, it would be then 120 or one. In Russian, it would be 119, right? Yeah. Okay. What is the first phrase at the very beginning in the Estonian Bible? What does it say? The very, very first phrase, Psalm 120. Okay, let's leave you till last. Russian. Let's see what Russian says. We'll leave Estonian to last. Maria, you. I already said you. Maria, what's the very first phrase? No, before that, there should be something else. A song of going up. Okay. Going up. Okay. Otto, Mari, what does the Finnish Bible say?
But very I have only English one
here. You have English. Okay. Otto, what does Finnish say? You have to turn your mic on.
Did you say Psalm 120 and verse 1?
The very first words. A song of?
It says in Finnish like song that is related to traveling or something.
A song that is related to traveling.
Yeah.
Okay. Mari, what does your English Bible say? Don't know which English one you have, so.
This says a song of ascent.
Ascent means to go up. Mm. Yeah. Now Estonian. Palvete konnalaul. A song of pilgrimage. Finnish Bible was a song of traveling. Is it a word like pilgrimage, being a pilgrim, or is it just general traveling?
I think the word is in general like something related to traveling, yeah.
So, which one is correct?
Estonian
says the Estonian. Of course, the Estonian says the Estonian. Literally in Hebrew, it is the song of going up, the song of ascent. The Russian and the English one that Mari and what mine has as well, song of ascent. Literally, it is going up. Okay, think about that. What is the sitzim leben? What's the setting in life where ancient Israelites would be singing a song as they go up? Go up where? Have you ever noticed in the Bible, in the Gospels, it will always say, if Jesus is going to Jerusalem, you do not go to Jerusalem. You go up to Jerusalem. The Jewish vocabulary is you go up to Jerusalem. Now, Jerusalem is on a little hill. You barely notice that it's a hill. It's on a little hill, but because it's the spiritual, it's the temple, it's the holy city, there are lots of hills and it's not the highest hill, but they developed this Jewish phrase, you go up to Jerusalem. And in the Mosaic law, there are a number of pilgrimage festivals where it says all Jewish people should go to Jerusalem for this festival. So a pilgrimage is a very important part of the Mosaic worship calendar. These annual pilgrimages, and Jesus does this several times, go up. Could these be songs that were specifically sung while the group of Jewish people were on pilgrimage for Passover or for the Feast of Tabernacles, and they are going up to Jerusalem? That's the way the Estonian Bible takes it. It's not a literal translation. Literally, it is simply a song of going up. But the Estonian Bible translators took the Sitzim Leben theory, this is a theory, that these were songs sung as they went in pilgrimage to Jerusalem.
How many such songs
are? Oh, how many are there? There's a whole series from Psalm 120 to 120 or 133, 34. There's a whole bunch in a row. There's a collection of them. 120 is the first, and then you just keep looking through the next 15 or so. They all start with the same phrase. The Russian English translation is just literal, a song of going up. What does that mean? But if you think of it as a pilgrimage, does that change your way of reading this? Do you have kind of a different emotional feeling? If you think about being in a group of believers traveling to Jerusalem for this religious festival, for Passover.
Festival, together and it's very powerful.
The very good example, like the Estonian Song Festival and the procession walking from, I mean, it takes hours and hours and hours, and you're so, you've done it probably.
Yeah.
You're so tired, but it feels good. It's an amazing feeling. So imagine being in that kind of a procession going to Jerusalem. It'd be powerful. So the next time you read these songs, that should be part of your thinking. Now, here's a question for you. Is it right? Literally, the word is the song of going up. It is an interpretation. And I haven't looked into the history of it. I'm guessing this is probably an ancient Jewish interpretation. I don't think this is a modern interpretation, but I'm not sure. Is it right? I hope so, because it's cool. I mean, it's a beautiful idea.
Looking at the songs, pilgrimage songs, they are kind of all saying, look up to the mountain, going to the holy place, kind of like acts.
Yeah, if you read through, you're right, you read through some of these psalms that are called the Psalms of Going Up. They talk about going up. Some of them do talk about going to the holy place, going to the temple. It does fit. I think it's a good interpretation. I think it's very likely. I'm just putting a little bit of humility into us. And I'll be honest, in some ways I like what the Estonian Bible translators did by putting it there, because then everybody understands. But at the same time, it's a little bit of a theory. I wouldn't say it's a fact. So it makes me a little bit, and that's why English and Russian Bibles don't put it so clearly. They translate the word literally, which is kind of safer. And that's kind of then a bit of a warning. This idea of Sitz im Leben, of trying to understand what is the setting behind the text, that's part of form criticism. It can be incredibly helpful. Like the example I gave, Matthew 23, and Jesus is condemning the Pharisees. And so the setting is a community that was being persecuted. That can really help our understanding of Matthew. But we need to remember it is a theory based on our modern understanding of what we see in the text. It makes sense. It's helpful. I think it's a good theory, but I will not say it's a fact. I will say it sounds like this is the situation. But if I may get to heaven and find out I'm wrong, Matthew might say, no, that's not what I was thinking. Okay. And I'll accept that. So there's some good tools here, but we need a little bit of humility. So there are some good things here. However, what do we have? 5 minutes before break time, right? Okay, let's see. However, there's also some problems if you get into form criticism in detail. And Hermann Gunkel, who started it, is really a very good example from the very beginning. Form criticism came out of the same philosophical tradition as source criticism. It came out of the Enlightenment. And remember, the Enlightenment said, human reason is the highest authority. God is the creator. He set things up to function according to natural laws, but God does not directly intervene in human life. So the miraculous, miracles, revelation, inspiration, those things are not part of Hermann Gunkel's understanding of what is possible or of what God does. And that creates huge issues. For example, Hermann Gunkel said that in the book of Genesis, there are two, well, in Genesis, in general, in the Old Testament, there's two different genres. There's history, which is history. But then there's something he calls saga, myth, legend. He uses the word saga. And he says these are two different genres. And what is Abraham? Stories of Abraham. Is it history or is it saga? Well, you have to see what's the difference between the two. Gunkel says, saga is oral tradition and imagination. So it's like family legends, passed down, folk tales that have been passed down from generation to generation, oral tradition with a lot of imagination. History, on the other hand, is a written, accurate scientific activity. Okay, that's history. It is written, it is accurate, it is scientific. In saga, sagas deal with the incredible. Stories, it's just incredible. History, on the other hand, deals with things that are credible. It's realistic. In saga, according to Gunkel, God is directly involved in an active way. But in history, God is the ultimate cause of existence. Yes, he's the creator. God exists. He's not an atheist. God is the ultimate cause of existence, but God is not directly involved. This is the Enlightenment deistic worldview, very, very clearly. So what about Abraham? Is Abraham saga or history? According to Gunkel, it's saga, because God calls Abraham, God talks to Abraham, God appears to Abraham. It is saga, it is not history. According to Gunkel, that's very clear. In other words, Gunkel denies the historicity of Abraham. Based on what? Does he have evidence that Abraham did not exist? No. It is simply his worldview, his theology, which says this is not something that really happens in the world. Therefore, this must be saga. It cannot be history. But if you read something that is saga, or you read something that is history, do you interpret those things the same? Will you understand something the same if you believe this is history, this is what really happened, or if you believe this is just a story, a legend, a myth? Will you interpret those the same way? No. You'll interpret them totally different. You'll treat them totally different. The meaning of the text is totally different, depending on whether you say it is saga or history.
So, from here, like the book of Esther or the history.
Esther.
Yes, because there is no mention of that.
Yeah, Esther, that's a good example. Based on this, if we only think about his worldview principles, then yes, Gunkel would say the book of Esther could be considered history, because God is not directly involved. God is behind the scenes manipulating things, but God is not directly a player. Yes. And there are other parts. For example, the story of the death of David and how Solomon becomes king. That's the beginning of 1 Kings, or 3 Kings in Russian. that's another example where everything that happens is very human, political. So there are some passages that they'll say this could be history. But if God is directly involved, then no, it's not history. But as I said, our theological understanding is very different. Give you another example. Go to the New Testament, Rudolf Bultmann. And I told you, Bultmann, I don't agree with most of what he writes. Oh, yeah, okay, got that. Same book where Bultmann is going through Matthew 8, which is the story of how Jesus heals the centurion servant. Remember the centurion? The story of the centurion servant, where the Roman soldier comes to Jesus and says, "My servant is sick. You don't have to come to my house, just say the word." You know the story, right? And Jesus says, this guy's got great faith, he's healed. And at that very moment, the man was healed. Rudolf Bultmann writes, well, hardly anyone will support the historicity of telepathic healing. He writes with great sarcasm. It's like, come on, nobody believes that. Well, sorry, but I think if God wants to do that, God can do that. But again, this is an example of how Bultmann, like Gunkel, is coming from what I defined at the beginning of the course as a very strongly liberal view of the way God is involved in life. He believes in the existence of God. Well, he did. He's dead. Now that he's dead, he believes much more. He believes in the existence of God. But his understanding of how God relates to this world is radically different from the understanding of the biblical authors or the understanding of a traditional Christian perspective. And that definitely affects then the way he interprets, the way he understands the story. So, Jesus healing the centurion servant. According to Bultmann, that's myth. He likes the word myth, not saga. Very similar. He calls it myth. It's not history, it's myth. In other words, and he does that systematically in his book, he goes through every miracle. And either he finds a way, well, no, he just goes through every miracle and just say it's myth, it's myth, it's myth, it's myth, it's myth. So all the miracle stories, he does this consistently, it's all myth. In other words, actually, we need to take a break. Okay, I'll leave you to think about that, what that means, and take a break, 15 minutes, and then come back.